Hey, this is John Lee Dumas of the award-winning podcast, Entrepreneurs on Fire, and you're listening to the Excelsior Journeys with George Soroy. Prepare to ignite.
So would you say that that's kind of like the lightning bolt moment for
you? And that's
why
I taught myself how to draw, was actually the Little Mermaid, drawing stills of Ariel.
I've got better things to do tonight than die.
Sylvester jumped out of his chair and said, who the F is this?
I remember walking out of the theater with him saying, I'm going to write Halloween.
I'm rather impressed with your research. Rarely do people ask me about Children in the Corn.
It doesn't have to be perfect. Just do it. You know, throw some spaghetti against a wall. See if it sticks.
This is George Soroy saying to all of you, ever upward. Welcome back to Excelsior Journeys, the road to creativity. This is George Soroy, and thank you so much for being here. And one of the genres that has really caught a lot of attention these days is historical fiction. What's great about this genre is that you can take these different major events in our lives and add an additional perspective by bringing in different characters and focusing on their perspectives. Instead of just giving a broad sense of what happened, we can actually kind of dig into the different people that were there through the eyes of these fictional characters. We've seen it so many times in different films. We've seen it so many times in different books. And we see that quite a bit in the books of my guest this week. Andrew Serra has been with the New York Fire Department for 25 years. He retired recently as captain of his department, and he has brought his own love of historical fiction into his writing of various historical fiction novels, including his latest one, Hell's Hundred Acres, which is all about the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire of 1911. But Andrew also brings an additional perspective because as part of the New York Fire Department, he was there for 9/11, but he was also able to provide he was also able to put the work into a 9/11 memoir called Finding John. I am really excited to hear about that, as well as Andrew's experience in historical fiction in general. And just thinking back to that time at 9/11, it was a very, very scary time. Since I am here in St. Louis, a lot of people have asked me, since I lived in New York City from 94 to 2011, what it was like on 9/11. Where was I on 9/11? And in my case, I don't really have much of a big story because I just happened to have the day off from work, and I had already scheduled those days from Monday through Thursday off. And that Monday, it was very gloomy. There was supposed to be a Yankees Red Sox game, but it got rained out. That was when the whole world changed. But Andrew was there as a member of the NYFD, and years later, he would revisit that time as an author. I am really excited to get into this conversation, to get Andrew's own perspective on historical fiction and the work that he has done and the work that he is doing. But it's my pleasure to introduce my guest this week, Andrew Serra. Andrew, how are you, sir?
Great. Thanks for having me on, George.
This is yet another Podmatch success story. This is one of the great things about the Podmatch website, is that you find a lot of people that you otherwise may not have connected with that are not part of your social circles. But when they connect, they wind up producing some really wonderful episodes, some really great conversations. And I'm sure that will be the case here. So thank you again for being here.
Yeah, great. No problem. Like I said, I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, so before we dive into your whole history with the fire department and with your writing, I think that's a very fascinating combination of the two there. You recently, just this past January, came out with the book Hell's Hundred Acres. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's a historical novel, as you said, about the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire from 1911. Mm-hmm. And initially was attracted to the story because after retiring, I was trying to come up with my next project, wondering what I would write about next. And while I was working, as you said, at the firehouse down in Soho, the firehouse itself is very old, an old historic company, and has a lot of history. And I was always fascinated by the history of that particular firehouse. And I really wanted to maybe dive into that and write something about that. And it turns out one of the most infamous and deadliest fires that firehouse responded to was the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire in 1911. They were one of the first units on the scene. So it was a natural progression to almost pivot the novel a little bit, and it really became the focal point of the whole novel, including this particular fire company that responded, but then also the time and the era and the politics going on in New York City that led to it, and the lives of the workers and the seamstresses of the factory, and how their lives were intertwined, and the factory owners, and how they all kind of came together in this one tragedy. So it kind of grew into a more fuller story in that regard.
Wow. And one of the factors that went into that, if I'm not mistaken, there was the bosses refusing to implement different safety protocols. Is that correct?
For sure. All factory owners at the time were pushing back against increasing safety measures, and including and especially fire safety. The owners of the Triangle factory, there were two partners, Max Blank and Isaac Harris were their names. They were probably the most successful of this particular type of garment. It was called a shirtwaist, if anyone's unfamiliar with it. It was a type of ladies' garment from the early 20th century. It was from about the turn of the century to about 1920. It was very popular. It was like a white blouse of like a lighter fabric. Sometimes it had like puffy shoulders and buttoned down in the front. It was worn over a skirt. And it was a very popular fashion item at the time. The most successful and richest of all the owners of these factories produced them. Most factory owners, profit was above everything else. In this particular factory, it was in a fairly modern building. The building was about 10 years old. It was a high-rise, 10-story loft building, loft factory. It's very spacious, very wide open floors. And there were two exit stairs. They were worried about workers stealing fabric at the end of the day. So they kept one exit stair locked, and they built a wooden partition in front of the other exit stair where there was like guards that would go through especially the women, the seamstresses, their purse and their coats to make sure that they weren't stealing any fabric at the end of the day. So it was basically like a bottleneck, like funnel through this partition where the workers could leave. So obviously in an event of a fire, this was a problem with the evacuation. So that was probably one of the biggest factors that led to the tragedy.
One of the exits was monitored by a couple of guards.
That door was kept open, but it still had a wooden partition in front of it where I don't know the exact dimensions of it, but it wasn't like a lot of people could run through it at once. It was almost like a single file exit. Mm. So there was definitely a bottleneck, and the other exit was completely locked.
Wow. How fast did that fire spread? Like it was.
It spread very quickly. It started on the factory occupied the 8th, 9th, and 10th floors of the building. And on the 8th floor, most of what they called the cutting was done. They were very skilled workers with the cutters. They used those giant scissors, and they had big work tables where they would pile up fabrics multiple inches thick of layers of fabric and cut it with the giant scissors. And they had scraps left over, and they would go in bins underneath the table. So there was that, and there was excess rolls of fabric and bolts of fabric kept in between tables. And then hanging from the ceiling were like templates. So whatever was being cut, a form of it, a sample, would be cut ahead of time, and then it would be wrapped with a very thin piece of metal to keep it taut and flat, and hung from like thin wire or rope from the ceiling. So all across the ceiling were these like basically cloth kites hanging all over the ceiling.
It was just a tremendous amount of kindling
or fire load. So it started, the best guess that investigators were able to come up with afterwards was probably a smoker, a cigarette or a match or some kind in one of the cutters bins. And it just took off from there very quickly. And then it spread throughout the 8th floor very quickly, and then quickly spread up to the 9th floor. And most of the deaths occurred from the 9th floor because there was a delay in notifying the people on the 9th floor, and then they just weren't able to evacuate. And over half of the deaths were people who had to jump out the windows because there was no other alternative.
So. Oh, my God. And then so you're researching all of this, but at the same time, you got firsthand experience from something that happened 90 years after that, like on September 11th.
I think there's obviously similarities between the large scale and newsworthiness of the tragedy, because the Triangle fire happened on a spring afternoon. There were a lot of people out in the street, a lot of photographers taking pictures, and it was a tragedy unfolded view of the public. A lot of times fire deaths happen, people burn inside a fire. It's terrible, but people from the outside can't watch it happening in real time. But when dozens and dozens of people are standing on a window ledge 9 stories up with flames behind them, it's just a tragedy that unfolds in front of people. Spoke about it for the rest of their lives. It was just such a shocking sight, and tragic sight to witness.
Right.
So, and with similarities, as you said, to 9/11. And from my own personal point of view, from this story, there had already been a lot written about the fire. There are a lot of great books out there, nonfiction books, even novels. mm-hmm. and documentaries. Didn't really have to look hard for material. Cornell University has a big database online of survivors, interviews, and resources. There's a lot out there. I was able to find material fairly easily. With all these great books out there, I thought, well, the one thing I could probably bring that would differentiate me from these other authors would be my experience fighting fires. The last maybe quarter to third of the book is the actual fire itself. And I tried to maybe be as detailed as I could to try and bring the experience of being trapped in this inferno to someone who's never experienced something like that. If I could maybe bring that across to the reader, maybe offer something new to the story. Correct. There's two probably main characters, and I have a point of view of about five or six characters throughout the book that I follow with the flashbacks and their back history. And with the exception of the two main characters who are fictional creations for the story, mm-hmm. Everybody else are real people from the time and from this event who were involved in this event actually there.
Wow. And so while you were putting this out and everything, did you feel like you really had something with this, like as it was coming along, like you were able to give it a whole other perspective that
grew like a little at a time? I think once I was able, I found a couple of really interesting avenues. I knew the fire company where I worked, I could bring their history into it and the history of the actual events of the fire and the politics and the history and the owners. There was enough out there, and I figured I could probably have enough to put a story together on that. One thing I was worried about was the seamstresses, who were such a huge part of the story in a lot of ways. I really wanted to make sure that I could do the best I could with getting their story right. And obviously, these are people I don't personally have a lot in common with in my own experiences. So to try and put myself in their shoes and tell their story, I think was something that I really wanted to take my time with and I'm worried about up front. The seamstresses who worked at Triangle were already kind of famous before the fire because the year before they had gone on strike. It was a very big strike amongst all ladies garment workers in New York City, and the Triangle seamstresses were a big part of it. It was followed by all the newspapers. They went on strike for a few months in the late summer of 1909 into the early months of 1910. The Triangle owners actually held out longer than any other owners. They never gave in to any of the strikers' demands, but they did raise the issue and get it into the news, into the people's consciousness a little bit, that these were the women who had went on strike for better working conditions. And a year later, here they are in one of the biggest workplace disasters, you know, in history. So there's that angle to it. And their life stories are really, really interesting in their own right. Most of them were very recent immigrants to this country who came here, either Italian or Eastern European Jewish immigrants came to this country not speaking the language. They were escaping extreme poverty, in many cases, violence and persecution in their own country, and came here with nothing and were living in very cramped tenement conditions and working very long hours at the Triangle. And their lives were so For many of them were very young, and to have experienced all that and then to be met with this catastrophe really is just, it's a lot. So that was part of the story that was almost a challenge, but almost surprising that I was able to really find enough with survivors' interviews and their points of views to hopefully be able to tell their story. Yeah. And I think one other pleasant surprise, I think, coming across was a man. His name was Edward Croker. He was the uniform chief of the New York City Fire Department at the time of the fire. He had been in his position for over 10 years. He was another one. He was like a kind of like a New York City tabloid newspaper hero at the time. He was always making headlines. He'd become quite famous as the authority nationwide on fire safety. And he was one of these larger than life characters. He always had a quote for the newspapers, and he had the first automobile in the fire department. So he was racing to fires. He was always leading from the front. He was a very charismatic figure. I found him to be very fascinating because if you lived in New York, I'm sure you're familiar with Tammany Hall.
Oh, yeah.
And the history of 19th century New York City politics, completely controlled by Tammany Hall, mm-hmm. which was basically a political club which controlled the Democratic Party in New York City, which in turn controlled basically all levels of public life and power in New York City. Mm-hmm. And it was very corrupt, but also very intertwined with the lives of especially immigrants and poor New Yorkers. And two things are true at the same time. It was a very corrupt system, but also they were really, in some ways, the only help that new arriving immigrants or poor New Yorkers were getting sometimes from Tammany Hall. You know, they would find you a place to live, find you a job, and the only thing they asked for was your vote. Yeah. So there, you have that whole history leading up to the turn of the century. And Edward Croker, who I mentioned, he comes from that world. His uncle was Richard Croker, who was the head of Tammany Hall. He gets his nephew appointed to the fire department. So there's these charges of nepotism, and he rises through the ranks fairly quickly. But he's one of these individuals who he's able to step out of the shadows of that past and really rises to the highest ranks of the department on his own merits. And he's a high level of professionalism and discipline and dedication to his job, where he ends up earning the admiration of not just the firefighters at the time, but the newspaper journalists who had been very critical of his early career. He ends up winning them all over. So I found him to be a very fascinating figure. And he ended up being a larger part of the book than I thought, because he was too interesting of a character to not be a big part of it.
And it sounds like he is really in all these other places, really, just like you can't avoid him. And someone who definitely, even though people would say that he got his spot from here, he could have just rested on his laurels and not done anything.
And he never did. Just like the seamstresses who had went on strike to demand better conditions, he had spent, you know, his decade as chief pushing for better fire safety measures. And almost every step of the way, he was rebuffed, with one exception, one important exception, actually. He had asked for sprinklers in factories, and he had always been denied that. He had asked for fire safety inspectors, and that was always denied. There was always pushback from the factory owners and the politicians. One thing he was able to achieve in the middle of that decade, maybe 1905-ish or so, he got the city of New York to build across Lower Manhattan a system of high-pressure water mains, because buildings were being built taller and taller as high-rise buildings were starting to come into construction. The water pressure of the existing water mains was just not sufficient to reach the upper floors, because you're fighting the head pressure of gravity. You have to overcome gravity to get water pressure on the upper floors of these buildings. Even though they had fire, like steam pumpers and engine pumpers to pump water to those, it still wasn't enough to reach the upper floors. So they built these massive turbines on the Hudson River and pumped in this large diameter water main across Lower Manhattan through the heart of this factory loft district, high pressure water into these large diameter hydrants, which actually was a factor at the Triangle fire. A lot went wrong that day. And in a lot of ways, the fire department's equipment, like the ladders, were just not tall enough. Of course, the technology of the day just was not available. A lot of things were just not adequate at the moment. One thing that was not an issue was water pressure. But even though 146 people died, which is terrible, once firefighters were on the scene and were able to get up to the 8th and 9th floor where most of the fire was, once they hooked up their hoses and charged it with the water, the fire actually went out fairly quickly. It was a very large amount of fire, but they put it out fairly quickly. The entire event lasted less than 30 minutes.
Wow. That's all it took for that.
From the first reports of fire, and then it took a couple of minutes for someone to pull the fire alarm box. The firefighters arrived, and then it was 28 minutes after firefighters arrived, it was deemed mostly under control. The main fire was knocked down and everything. It was just those initial stages, the fire spread so quickly, and people were cut off and trapped and had no choice. And like I said, over 70 people ended up jumping out those ninth floor windows because they had no choice.
That's terrible. And do you think that the Triangle owners, do you think they put in those additional protocols as a means of punishment for the seamstresses marching, going on strike?
No, I mean, they certainly were not kind to the women on strike. They employed very dirty tactics. They used hired thugs to rough up the picketers. They employed a couple of tactics that were reported at the time, including they would hire prostitutes to march on the picket line with the picketers. And then the police would come and see the prostitutes and arrest all the picketers for prostitution. So it's like just to smear them and just like just dirty tactics. And if any of the picketers tried to defend themselves in any way, they were hauled off and arrested for attacking the police. Or it was just they certainly were not above petty retribution and stuff like that. It's a very complicated history. The two owners themselves, they were immigrants to this country and came here with nothing as children. And they worked in the sweatshops, even in regard to the Triangle Fire. And people say, oh, it was a fire in a sweatshop. But it's technically not true. And the term itself, sweatshop, originates from a very specific type of setup. And it really goes back to like the generation before the Triangle Fire, where mostly in tenement buildings, a number of small scale, I wouldn't even call them companies. They were just like independent contractors. Somebody in an apartment would put four or five sewing machines in the parlor room of a tenement apartment. And it would be very dark, very little ventilation, cramped and very, very hot. And women would be stooped over them 12, 14 hours a day, just with, pedaling their feet and creating garments. And then these contractors would have like running boys who would run to like some kind of distribution center in the neighborhood and bring the finished product there and come back with more raw materials. And basically they were independent contractors in as much as they were paid by the garment they produced, per garment. And then they in turn paid the women working per finished garment. And the term sweatshop meant they would literally try to sweat out as much production as they could out of these workers. So that's where the term comes from, sweatshop. Uh-huh. And then these two owners grew up working in these conditions.
Right.
So now they build them, they somehow scrimp and save and work and end up owning their own company and being very successful. By the time they have the Triangle Company in this modern factory loft building, it's very spacious. It's a wide open floors surrounded by windows, plenty of fresh air and light, high ceilings, not cramped conditions at all. So in their mind, conditions are way better than they ever were. Everything's relative. So they have a hard time believing why anyone would complain about working in such quote unquote wonderful conditions compared to what they were used to. I think everything's relative, and maybe that's how they justified it in their mind. And they never wanted to give an inch, especially when it came to the strikers. And they held out until the strike was over. And then the workers just really had no choice but to go back to work.
Wow, that's incredibly fascinating. I'm really looking forward to reading this for myself and seeing how everything unfolded. I'm also curious to know what exactly got you on this road to creativity in the first place, because you had spent 25 years in the fire department, but you also said that you've had a love for writing for a lot of your life as well. And you only started writing it's about 2012, correct?
Well, that was the first book I published in 2012. I've been writing since I was a kid, always loved creating stories and writing, whether it's short stories, poems, whatever just was in front of me at the time, whatever I was interested in. And I started writing in 2012. I always loved historical fiction. I'm a big history buff, even nonfiction history books. I'm always fascinated by that type of reading. But the thing I love about historical fiction is the freedom as a writer to not just put facts on the paper, but you could really kind of dive into the people involved. Even if you're writing about real people, you could really try to find the emotion, find the motivations for whatever actions were going on at the time, find that common thread between people of all eras and time periods. I think we have a lot more in common with people in the past than we think. They woke up in the morning with hopes and dreams. They had fears. They had good days and bad days, just like we do, whether they were in the Middle Ages or the ancient world or wherever. The human experience kind of carries across. And I think as writing historical fiction, you can really try to bring that out and bring the fullness of those stories to the reader.
And it's a great way to kind of bring a little bit of familiarity to the story, even though you're introducing your reader to a world that they may not be familiar with at all. But just like you said, the characters that embody this story, that are going through it, they have the same sort of hopes, dreams, fears, thoughts, and desires as we do, just in a different time period. So that's a great way to look at it. And so what was the first one the first story that you decided to put out there?
In 2012, I put out a historical novel. It was called The Dead Florentines. And it basically centers around the Italian Renaissance.
Oh, wow.
15th and early 16th century Florence, Italy. I was studying Italian at the time and fascinated by that era. It just attracted me. So I dove into it, and that's where I came up with that idea.
Once you were able to figure out the hook, figure out your characters. You got the story down. You worked at it. You got everything where it needed to be. What was the next step for it? Did you decide to go indie? Did you decide to try to get it published through a publisher? What was your next step there?
Yeah, all independent published. Started with learning as I went with the process of publishing and finding independent publishing platforms and stuff until eventually I ended up just basically starting my own publishing company, very small, just for my own writings, basically.
Yeah, you're not opening it to others, but at the same time, you gave yourself an imprint.
Correct.
Yeah. Great. That's a great way to do it. And so once everything was all finished, you got the formatting, you got the editing. Do you have a team that you were able to bring in to help you with this?
No, I learned as I went. I found some resources online with friends and family. The first book, I had a launch party with friends and family, got the word out, and that was it. I learned a lot. I think it was an important book for me. I learned a lot about the process and was able to, my first two books, I think I learned a lot about the process. And by the time 2018 came and I was ready, I put out my first nonfiction book, the 9/11 memoir that you mentioned. I had a lot of, I was able to draw on the experience of the prior two fiction books of putting it together. And I think it helped out my memoir a lot, having those experiences behind me when going into that project.
Oh, man. And what was the experience for you when you got the whole thing taken care of and that you are holding that finished book in your hands, that first book? Because you never forget your first.
When finally you get the box from the printer and you open it up and you see copies of the book, that is a great feeling.
And they were all printed, right?
No, I can't. Like everyone else, you get that first galley copy, and it's never happened where I haven't gotten the first proof copy and not found a typo or something that needed
right.
No matter how many times it's been edited and read and proofread.
Always happens. Yep.
Always happens. Always find something. So you go through it and then you go from there.
Was there kind of like a rush where you were just like, ooh, this is a good feeling having this book out. I want to do more of this. Is that what got
you
going?
Yeah, I think that's why I don't mind so much, like you said, having my own imprint and put it. I actually do enjoy the process of building the book.
And you get to make your own schedule and everything and you're not.
Right. And you keep control over it. Mm-hmm. With the cover design and working with professionals. I always try to put my best foot forward in that way. You get to be deeply involved in it on every step of the way and make all the decisions and work with them as opposed to having it made for you, those decisions.
Yeah. Were you able to bring those finished books into the fire department itself?
In what way?
Or separate from the work?
I, for the most part, kept them separate. And that's why I was hesitant to, for a lot of reasons, I was hesitant to write Finding John. I mean, first and foremost, it was just I didn't think I could write about 9/11. People would ask me a lot, especially having at that point put out two other books, if I ever thought about writing about 9/11. And I would always say no. I didn't think I could do it. It just seemed too overwhelming. Mm-hmm. I didn't know how I could organize my thoughts and really tell any part of the story, or it just seemed like too overwhelming to go down that road. There was also the aspect, being an active uniform member of the department, there are certain restrictions too about, in certain things you need permission for to write. If you're using the official fire department name and writing about operations and things like that. But actually I was able to, I didn't have any problems in that regard. The FDNY press office were behind the project at the time. And really, the obstacles really for me were just overcoming my initial reluctance to write.
Do you think a big part of that was the fact that you were coming to them not as an outsider? You were kind of like coming from the perspective of someone who was there, someone who was part of the NYFD at that time. So like,
I think so, yeah. That could have been a part of it. From that point of view, I think there's a lot of requests from journalists and everyone all over the world to write about the fire department, and they call up headquarters asking the press desk for, can we interview this one? Can we talk to that one? Can we take pictures in this firehouse? And they evaluate each one on if there's a value to the public having this interview done and what kind of light it puts the fire department in and stuff like that. But like I said, I didn't have any issues with that. I was worried about it, but I ended up having no issues in that regard. And it was really just my own reluctance to get over to write about it.
Gotcha. I know how it is where you have this story that's been kind of building up and you almost like there is that feeling of like, oh, this is too personal. This is too hard hitting. Do I want to go into that? And knowing everything that goes into making a book, I'm sure that had come to mind as well, because this was not going to be just like something you were going to spend a week on. There was going to be a lot of work to do there.
With any book, you get a lot of ideas for a book, and it's the best idea in the world for about a half hour. Mm-hmm. And then you realize, if I go this way, for the next 18 months or 2 years, I'm going to live in this world. I'm going to write about a pirate ship. Do I want to live in the pirate world for the next 8 years?
Yep.
Or whatever I'm writing about. So it's like, and then you talk yourself out of it. So I knew going into writing about 9/11, I'm going to go back there and be in that mindset. And it really just started simply. I had my laptop open one day, and I just decided, let me write one chapter. And I wrote one chapter all in one shot, just sat there and wrote it, finished. And I thought about it, and I'm like, oh, that wasn't too bad. I think I could do this.
Yeah.
And then I went back and I started researching and finding people to interview and gathering documents, because it's not just a straightforward memoir. It's a kind of like a memoir and investigative history about a particular episode from September 11th that really motivated me to write. And I could give you a quick recap if you want. It's basically what happens is, so now September 11th happens, and then very quickly that evening, and then in the weeks and months follows, city officials and federal, everyone, they set up the recovery site of the World Trade Center. It becomes a recovery area. There's rescues in the first couple of days, and then recovery. So I was down there on a rotating basis like so many other people. And and it was March of 2002. Working overnight at the recovery that I was working with a handful of other firefighters, and we found the remains of a firefighter in the rubble. Man. So I found out who he was. His name was John Tipping. That's where Finding John comes from. I didn't know him in life. I knew the name now from finding. And it was one of those moments that will always stay with me. You feel a connection to this individual just to be there in that moment. And so it always stayed with me. The recovery site closes, and later in 2002, it starts as a series in magazine articles, and then it's put out as one book from a journalist. And this journalist had been granted access to the recovery site for the, I think it was about 8 or 9 months that it was open, the site.
Yeah.
The whole time this journalist had access to the site. So he went around the site, observed everything, and then he wrote the series of articles. And in his reporting is a story that he claims that one particular fire company arrived at the before the collapse. So after the two planes hit, they arrived at the burning Twin Towers.
Right.
And according to this report, he says the company pulls up out front, they get off and go in the building. But instead of going upstairs to help people, they went, because underneath the World Trade Center, and I'm sure if you're aware, there was a shopping mall, like in the basement and concourse levels. And like there was a connection between the two towers. It was a large shopping mall with all stores.
Oh, yeah. I've been there. Yeah, I remember going there in 94 when I was a senior in high school.
So he claims this company ran in, went downstairs and started looting merchandise.
Oh, man.
Basically, and was stealing merchandise, in particular, he says, clothing and in particular jeans from the Gap store.
Really?
Underneath. And they were loading the merchandise onto their truck. And while they were in the act of looting this merchandise, the collapse came down and killed this crew.
Wow.
So he writes a story. He, you know, he doesn't explicitly name the company in his story, but it was very quickly figured out which company he was talking about at the time when it came out. And it turns out that the firefighter whose remains I found was one of the firefighters in this company who was killed that day.
Really?
And I remember hearing about that, and it destroyed me in a lot of ways, hearing that this could be said. I knew, I don't know why, I just felt it, just knowing, like, I knew it couldn't be true that anyone would do something like that. One of the worst tragedies and imaginable. And instead of helping people, you're worried about free clothing. Like it just, none of it made sense. It just was such a ridiculous story. And so it just always stayed with me, and years went by, and really it just ate away at me. And it was 15 years later. It was like maybe 2016 or so that's when I decided to write. And I said, I didn't know what I could add to so much had been written about 9/11, even at that time. I said, well, what do I have to add to the story? I said, well, I'm going to find out the truth about this fire company. Other reporters had looked into it at the time, and it had been debunked, but the story never The Truth never really got the same traction or the same publicity as the initial.
It never does. The correction is always put on page 36 and one paragraph.
Exactly. So like I said, I sat down one day and I wrote that first chapter and I said, I think I could do this. I closed the computer and that's it. I set to work to get to the bottom of it. I found witnesses. I found as much documentation. There's dispatch records. There's audio and video tapes I found and survivors. Basically, I was able to piece it all in together. Like I said, other people had reported on this, but I wanted all the evidence and as much as I could find out about this company to be in one place. Mm-hmm. And as it turns out, not only were they not stealing when they died, they were absolute heroes up until the last second of their life. Unlike so many other people who died that day, where we really don't know what they were doing when they died. We just know this particular company, we have a pretty good picture of what they were doing. And they were specially called. They arrived with special instructions from the dispatcher to report to the South Tower lobby because people were stuck in the elevators in the lobby. Mm. So basically the planes hit, there were people in the elevator and the elevators became jammed in between floors in the lobby and they weren't moving. And now it had burning jet fuel pouring into the elevator shafts and burning at the bottom of the shaft. So the people were trapped in them. So this fire company is dispatched for this reason, and they pull up very close to the front of the South Tower entrance.
Yeah.
Most of the companies responding at this point in the operation were responding to a staging area on the West Side Highway. Mm-hmm. They pull up right up to the highway because they want to bring special equipment in to deal with the people trapped in this elevator.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you're familiar with the term, the jaws of life. So it's actually called a Hearst tool, but it's colloquially known, most people know it as the jaws of life. The type of unit that was in service at that time in 2001, it was very bulky. It had two parts. Yeah. It was a large gas powered generator and then a hose and then the actual jaws. And it took two or three people to move it, to bring it in. So that's why they pulled up so close to the front entrance and they brought this in.
Yeah.
Consequently, what would happen is because they were parked so close, when the collapse occurred, the fire truck was pushed down into the shopping concourse and it did have merchandise near it. And on these firefighters brought the jaws of life into the lobby and they were able to rescue one woman. They saved her life from this elevator and she was brought out and put in an ambulance and they were still working on these jammed elevator doors, trying to get the rest of the people out when the collapse occurred. So right up to the last second of their lives, they were heroes.
Wow.
That was my goal, to get that story out there.
Do you feel that definitely played a big part in redeeming them, like in the eyes of the public?
Yeah, I mean, in as much as I feel like if somebody were to want to learn about this particular episode, if they were able to find my book, hopefully it can be a part of the conversation. The journalist, his book was very popular at the time. I'm sure it's still discussed in the history of the event. So
yeah,
I'm not as popular an author as he is, but maybe it can just be hopefully found and talked about. I think the most rewarding part was the families of these firefighters. They were able to read it and a few of them expressed gratitude and were very positive about the project overall. So, and that was very rewarding for me. And so if nothing else, for them to be able to see it in print, that what they knew all along is that like their husbands or fathers or loved ones were heroes.
Excellent. Okay. So it sounds like you really did a great service for them. You were able to give some real peace of mind for people that may have still had some form of doubt about what was going on.
Yeah. I hope, like I said, a lot of the witnesses I found and the evidence that it was there, hopefully the families would find some comfort in there and that I was able to put it together in a way to put their mind at ease that there would ever be any doubt. Because like I said, they knew. And I think any firefighter, anyone who is completely implausible, the story at all. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I do remember that period of time when not only 9/11 itself, but the days that followed. And like you said, then the whole area became a recovery site. One of the things that I remember happening a lot during those early weeks afterwards was how everyone really came together. Or the people that I knew from work that would go to work and then they would go down to the site and prepare food and do whatever they could, like for all the different rescue workers that were on site. And then after a while, that just kind of faded away a little bit. And now with the current climate that we're in right now, everything just seems so polarized. Do you think there's a chance for us to, at least in New York, see that sort of unity again without something like this happening?
That's a tough question. Even on small levels, right? You have a family. When there's a tragedy, the family pulls together. And I think the city pulled together, and in a lot of ways, the country pulled together for a while. Obviously, we wouldn't want something like that to happen again just to achieve such unity. It ties back to what we said before about the human condition and what we have in common with people of all times. And you don't want to see deep hatred or deep polarization or certainly not violence or anything like that.
Right.
But a certain amount of disagreement, I think, is healthy. It's like after a tragedy, everyone pulls together and is on the same page because you have a unity of like you're all focused on one goal just to get through this tragedy. And then you go back to disagreeing about normal things.
Everyone goes back to your corners. You know,
this side thinks taxes should be here. This side thinks it should be here. And you make your argument and you disagree, and then that's what democracy is all about. I'd like to see it more civil than it is today and more without the name calling and on both sides and all that stuff. I think that's normal. Like you said, think of a family, you have a tragedy, you pull together, and then life slowly goes back to the way it was and more mundane, more daily concerns creep back in.
Yeah.
And that's natural, I guess, to a certain extent.
Well, here's hoping that we can kind of pull ourselves out of the current funk that we seem to be in, and that way we can kind of get back to some healthy disagreements, but also healthy compromises.
Just dial it back a little bit, right?
Yeah, exactly. Just like it's amazing what can happen if you just, like you said, dial it back a little bit. So I'm hoping that the books that you come out with are providing that additional perspective, because I think that a lot of people can look at what you have already and just say, like, wow, these people, like we said before, these people really are just like us and they got through this. But at the same time, like, can we go through something that may not be as tragic as this or this, but at least something that we can build upon?
Right. Yeah, and find, like you said, there's nothing new under this, you know, there's everything, it's not unique, and hard times come, and unfortunately tragedies sometimes, and life, you move forward. And I think the thing I love about books and literature is it's a link to the past and hope for the future all at the same time sometimes. You can find all of that in stories, right?
Yeah. I love that. A link to the past and hope for the future. That's a perfect exclamation point here. And where can my listeners find you on social media?
AndrewSerra.com is my website with links to all social. Andrew Serra, author, is social media handle. And you find my books wherever you get the Amazon, Barnes & Noble, on my website. They're available.
Excellent. And I hope that all of you who are listening are able to take some solace in what Andrew is doing here. He is providing these stories that, just as he said, offer a look to the past and provide hope for the future. That is the greatest thing that a creative can do, especially these days. And I hope that those of you who are listening are able to pick up these stories, learn from them, enjoy them, and keep picking up more, because the more that we can learn from the past, the better off we have a chance to be for the future. So, and I've said this many times before, in these crazy times, we need your voices, we need your stories now more than ever. So for Andrew Serra, this is George Soroy saying to all of you, ever upward, and I will see you next week.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of Excelsior Journeys. I hope it was both inspiring and entertaining. Special thanks to Zach Comtois for providing new music for the intro and outro. please take a moment to leave a rate and review on Apple Podcasts. And if you enjoy the show, please share it with your friends and subscribe to your platform of choice by going to hesgotit.com/podcasts. While there, you can also fill out the application to be a guest, inquire about sponsorship opportunities, and click on the Buy Me a Coffee link if you wish to give your support to the show. All interaction is very much appreciated. If you have a question, comment, or suggestion for the show, please direct it to George@hesgotit.com.